All right, let's jump right in today. We're going to be looking at a period that I think is really fascinating in Irish history.
Yeah.
It's the Anglo-Irish Treaty and the Civil War that followed.
It's a big one.
It is a big one. And you've actually shared a chapter from what looks like a secondary school textbook.
Right.
So this is going to be a really good overview for us to kind of unpack all this pivotal stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, this period really gets to the heart of what it means to make peace after a long and bitter conflict like the War of Independence.
Yeah, and there's so many decisions and people involved, so it's going to be interesting to see, like, you know, what they were thinking at the time.
Absolutely, yeah.
I guess, just starting right at the beginning, one thing that stood out to me was de Valera's decision not to go to the treaty negotiations in London.
Right.
He sent a delegation, but he stayed back in Dublin?
Right.
Which seems like a really strange move,
yeah.
You know? I've heard some arguments that it actually weakened the Irish position going into the talks.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it definitely was controversial, but I think there's a lot of debate over why he made that choice. Some believe he wanted to, you know, present this hardline stance back home, which could have given his negotiators a bit more, you know, leeway in London to be a bit more flexible.
Oh, I see what you mean. So almost like he could then step in later and be the, like, good cop, offering that compromise if needed.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's a really interesting tactic.
It is. And, you know, it raises the question, did de Valera truly believe a deal could even be struck? Or was he, like, already setting the stage for something else?
Yeah, it makes you think, right?
Yeah.
It almost seems like he was thinking steps ahead.
Absolutely. And, you know, regardless of his intentions, it definitely created a very unique dynamic for those at the negotiating table.
Right. And speaking of the Irish delegation, the chapter mentions Griffith, Collins, Barton.
Right.
All big names. Mm-hmm. But they had their own opinions even before they stepped foot in London.
Exactly. And I think that's what really gets to the heart of why the treaty ended up being so divisive. You know, you had Griffith, the pragmatist. He was, you know, open to compromise, wanted to find a solution.
Yeah.
And then you had Collins, who, you know, with his military background, he understood what the limitations of the IRA would be if the war actually continued.
Right, right.
And then, you know, you had Barton, who was a very staunch Republican. So he was going to be holding fast to that, you know, ideal of a fully independent republic, no matter what.
Yeah, I can only imagine being a fly on the wall in those negotiations. Mm. What a mix of personalities and priorities.
Exactly. And, you know, then you throw in their plenipotentiary status.
Right. Right.
I mean, they could actually sign a treaty, but they were also instructed to refer back to Dublin before doing so. Mm-hmm. Talk about a confusing mandate, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, how do you even begin to approach a negotiation like that?
Yeah.
It's like they had the authority, but were also constantly looking over their shoulders.
Exactly, yeah. So much pressure.
And then, of course, there was the issue of Ulster. The chapter talked about how partition was just months old at that point.
Mm-hmm.
A major sticking point right from the get-go.
Absolutely. I mean, they went in with the goal of a united Ireland, even suggesting this idea of external association. It was a clever attempt to sort of bridge the gap.
Oh, interesting. How so?
So basically, they were imagining an independent Ireland that was still, you know, voluntarily linked to Britain, particularly in areas like trade and defense.
Right, right.
So almost like, you know, trying to have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah. Do you think they really thought the British would buy into that?
It was definitely a long shot. I mean, the British weren't budging on the idea of a fully independent Ireland.
Yeah, it was never going to be that easy, was it?
No, no. And, you know, the whole thing became this back and forth, with, like, the threat of renewed war always kind of hanging in the air.
The stakes were incredibly high.
Exactly, yeah. And that's where Lloyd George comes in.
Right. The chapter kind of paints him as this, like, very shrewd negotiator, but also someone who was obviously juggling his own political pressures back in London.
Absolutely. I mean, he was stuck between a rock and a hard place. While he may have been sympathetic to some Irish aspirations, he also had to answer to the Conservatives back in London, many of whom were staunch Unionists, right?
So even if he wanted to be more lenient, he couldn't really be.
Exactly.
It makes you wonder, though, with all of those limitations, were the Irish negotiators, like, truly naive in their expectations? Or were they actually playing some different game altogether?
Ooh, that's a really interesting question. It does make you wonder, right? Maybe they knew exactly what the British could and couldn't offer, so they were aiming for something more strategic with their own long-term goals in mind.
Hmm. Yeah, like a different kind of chess match.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about the compromises then. The chapter mentions the Boundary Commission as a major sticking point.
Right. So the Irish obviously wanted a united Ireland, But Lloyd George managed to convince Griffith to accept a commission that would redraw the border between North and South.
Ah, so this is that whole thing with Lloyd George apparently assuring the Irish that this commission would probably transfer nationalist areas in the North back to the South.
Right.
And then at the same time, he was telling unionists that it would protect their interests.
Exactly, yeah. It was a classic case of telling different people what they wanted to hear.
Playing both sides.
Absolutely.
It's amazing to think that, you know, they were actually buying into that.
It's hard to know for sure what they were truly thinking. Maybe they were genuinely convinced. Maybe they just felt it was the best they could get under such extreme pressure.
Right, right.
But one thing's for sure, the whole Boundary Commission thing would prove to be another huge source of controversy and disappointment down the road.
Yeah. So we've got this pressure cooker situation. A British negotiator who's, you know, playing everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And this Irish delegation that's got its own internal divisions. What happens when the clock runs out?
Well, in the early hours of December 6, 1921, they find it, the Anglo-Irish Treaty.
And with that signature, things really changed for Ireland. I guess that's a story for part two. But before we move on, I'm really curious, from what you've read and your expertise, what really stands out to you about this early stage of the whole thing?
Oh, that's a great question. I think for me, it's really fascinating how, despite all the pressure and the complexities, both sides were still trying to find some kind of common ground. You know, even though the end result was far from perfect,
yeah.
There was this like glimmer of hope that maybe, just maybe, they could figure this out peacefully, even with all the, you know, baggage and mistrust.
Yeah, it's almost tragic in a way.
Yeah, it is.
Knowing what we know now about what was to come.
Absolutely.
But, you know, it's a reminder that even in the midst of such intense conflict, there's always this potential for, you know, reason and diplomacy. Even if it's just a fleeting moment.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, yeah. It's a powerful lesson for, you know, any negotiation, really.
Yeah.
Especially those dealing with really deep-rooted issues.
All right. Well, with that in mind, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and dive into the details of the treaty itself and all that followed.
Sounds good. I mean, signing that treaty without even consulting the Dáil back in Dublin?
Oh, yeah.
Huge gamble.
Talk about walking into a lion's den.
Mm.
You know, you'd have relief that the fighting was over, but also anger, betrayal. This wasn't the republic that so many had envisioned, right?
No, it wasn't. And you can just imagine the tension in the Dáil chamber when they brought it back.
Oh, I bet.
Just this nation, you know, exhausted from years of conflict.
Yeah.
Now having to grapple with this, like, was it a victory or was it actually a defeat?
I mean, the chapter does such a good job of capturing that. Like, you know, you had supporters, people like Griffith and Collins, who argued that this was the best they could possibly get.
Right.
They said, look, this offers us more than home rule ever would have.
Mm.
And the alternative is just unthinkable. We can't go back to war.
And their argument was pretty compelling, right? They presented dominion status, like Canada, Australia,
You
know, a stepping stone to full independence,
mm.
a chance to really build a nation from within.
But then on the other hand, you had this very fierce opposition.
Right.
People who saw this as a betrayal, a surrender to British imperialism after all that they'd fought for.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that oath of allegiance, you know, that really stuck in their craw.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to them, it symbolized this, like, continued subservience to the crown.
Yeah.
Which, after everything, that must have felt like a humiliation.
It really was a slap in the face, wasn't it? And, you know, you had the Bishop of Limerick.
Right.
Really pushing the Dáil to accept it.
Saying it was, what was it? A signal victory.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting how he framed it, you know, appealing to the sacrifices already made.
Yeah.
And the fact that they'd actually, you know, forced the empire to negotiate in the first place.
That's a powerful way to look at it, for sure.
But then you also had Cathal Brugha, this veteran of the Easter Rising who just absolutely denounced it.
Yeah.
I mean, his words were something else. He said accepting dominion status was like drinking a draft of poison.
Yeah, powerful imagery there.
Yeah, national suicide, two such starkly contrasting views.
Exactly. And, you know, I think it really highlighted the impossible situation that Ireland was in at the time, trying to reconcile these very, very different visions of the future.
Yeah. And the vote itself reflected that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it passed, but just...
Yeah, 64 to 57.
Razor thin.
It was a victory for the pro-treaty side, but it definitely came at a cost.
Yeah, because it didn't feel like anything was actually resolved, right?
No.
It seemed like it just made those existing cracks even deeper.
Absolutely.
And from there, it just feels like this like collision course towards civil war.
It really does. And I think this is where understanding the figures like Arthur Griffith and Michael Collins becomes so important. I mean, they weren't just politicians, they were symbols of that whole struggle. So their support for the treaty had real weight.
Right. And the chapter gave a little bio of Griffith, you know, tracing his journey from this cultural nationalist to pragmatist.
Right.
He seemed to really believe that the treaty was a realistic path towards independence. Not the ideal path necessarily, but a realistic one.
It's hard to know for sure, you know, what was going through his mind. Was he truly convinced, or was he just trying to make the best out of this really terrible situation?
Yeah.
He definitely understood the need for pragmatism in politics.
And then there's Collins, the big fella.
Yeah.
The chapter describes him as this, like, brilliant strategist, the brains behind the IRA's intelligence operations.
Mm-hmm.
He was deeply involved in all of this, but there's that famous line of his, you know, where he basically says, "I've signed my own death warrant."
Yeah, it's chilling when you think about it, isn't it? He knew that this was going to make him a target for those who saw the treaty as a betrayal.
He seemed very aware of the risks that he was taking.
Yeah, he did. He understood the need for peace, but also that deep yearning for a republic.
It's such a heavy burden.
Yeah, it is.
And I think that quote just perfectly captures that whole weight of the situation.
It does. And, you know, unfortunately, his premonition ended up coming true.
Yeah. So the treaty's ratified, but obviously it's not a smooth path ahead.
Yeah.
The IRA itself becomes this kind of microcosm of the divisions within Irish society.
Right. You had pro-treaty and anti-treaty factions emerging, you know, mirroring that political split.
And then you had the Provisional Free State Government, led by Griffith and Collins.
Right.
They're trying to assert their authority.
Trying to get things in order.
The chapter mentioned the handover of Dublin Castle.
Yeah, what a moment.
Right? That must have been incredibly symbolic.
I mean, the Irish flag flying over Dublin Castle for the first time in centuries.
Yeah, you would think that would be this, like, fresh start.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
But then what happens?
Well, some anti-treaty IRA units refused to recognize the new government. They occupied buildings, like the four courts.
Right.
It was a direct challenge to the Free State's legitimacy.
It just seems like this, like, uneasy peace. It just unraveled so quickly.
Yeah.
Wait. I mean, these were people who had fought side by side, now staring each other down, weapons in hand.
It's just heartbreaking to think about, isn't it? The betrayal.
And then Collins, ever the pragmatist, he's trying to avoid an all-out war.
Yeah.
He tries to form an electoral pact with De Valera.
Right. He wanted to unite those factions.
But there was that one sticking point.
The British insisted that the Oath of Allegiance stay in the Constitution.
So even though they technically gained some independence, they were still operating within the confines set by British interests.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. The collapse of that pact was a huge turning point. The stage was set for civil war.
All right, so before we get into the actual conflict itself,
okay,
what's your take on all of this so far? It seems like every single decision, every compromise, just pushed them closer and closer to the brink.
It's true, isn't it? And, you know, it's easy to look back and judge, but you have to try to put yourself in their shoes.
Yeah.
I mean, these were incredibly difficult choices made under immense pressure. There were no easy answers. And unfortunately, every decision seemed to have these, like, unintended consequences.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I think it ultimately led them down this path that no one really wanted.
To the unthinkable.
Yeah. It really is hard to grasp that shift, you know, from comrades to enemies. It's almost impossible to wrap your head around.
And the chapter really dives into the brutality of it all.
Yeah.
It's not shying away from that at all.
All right.
So what were the key events then that really plunged Ireland into this civil war?
Well, I mean, it all really comes back to that four courts occupation.
Right.
You know, you've got the anti-treaty IRA holding that building, directly challenging the Free State's authority. Collins, under pressure from the British,
right,
had to restore order. So he makes that agonizing decision to shell the four courts.
And using artillery borrowed from the British, no less?
Yeah, I know.
It's almost Shakespearean, isn't it?
It is. It's like the very forces they'd fought together against now being used to tear them apart.
It's tragic.
It is. And, you know, the tragedy is amplified when you think about the motivations on both sides.
Right, right.
I mean, you had all these young men so passionate about their country.
Yeah.
But with fundamentally different visions for what that country should be.
The chapter really highlights the human cost of the war. And it was relatively short, wasn't it?
Yeah. under a year.
But still, significant casualties.
Oh, absolutely.
And it wasn't just a rank and file either, right?
No, no.
Some major figures, people who had really shaped the fight for independence, they lost their lives in this conflict as well.
It was the who's who of the movement.
Like Cathal Brugha, for example.
Right.
He died fighting in Dublin.
Yeah, street fighting.
And then you had Harry Boland.
Right. Close friend of Collins.
Died resisting arrest.
It's incredible how many of those central figures, they didn't make it through.
And then Arthur Griffith himself.
Yeah.
The architect of the treaty.
Yeah. You know, he died probably from a brain hemorrhage.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, it makes you wonder the stress, the pressure of it all.
It must have been immense.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's Collins.
The big fella.
Ambushed and right. killed in his own county.
Yeah.
It's hard to even put into words the impact of that.
I know.
Both on the war itself and just on Irish history as a whole.
It's huge. I mean, he was a charismatic leader,
yeah.
you know, the symbol of the struggle. And his death, it really demoralized the pro-treaty side.
Right.
I think it intensified the bitterness, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh.
And the chapter also mentioned the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Obviously a huge force at the time in Ireland.
Yeah, yeah.
And they sided with the Free State.
Mm.
Even excommunicating those who were involved with the anti-treaty activities.
Which must have had a huge impact, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to have that level of condemnation from the church, it really would have weakened support for the Republican campaign.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it probably contributed to their eventual defeat.
So you've got these key leaders gone.
Right.
Resources are dwindling. The church is against them. How does it all end?
Well, I mean, the anti-treaty IRA under Liam Lynch, they were committed.
Really committed.
Oh, yeah. They rejected calls for a truce, even from De Valera.
Oh, wow. So even he, after opposing the treaty so fiercely, he was starting to see that continuing the war was futile.
Yeah. And I think his shifting perspective here is crucial.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, another tragic loss, Liam Lynch.
Right. The IRA leader.
He is killed in a skirmish, and this paves the way for Frank Aiken to take command.
Aiken was more open to dialogue, right?
He was, and he actually supported De Valera's call for a ceasefire.
Mm.
And so on May 24th, 1923, Aiken orders a ceasefire, effectively ending the war.
Peace, but at what a cost. The physical devastation.
Yeah.
The economy was in shambles.
Yeah.
And these deep political and social scars.
Yeah.
I mean, it's difficult to imagine how long those would take to heal.
Generations.
Generations, exactly. And I think it's so important to remember that the Civil War, it didn't just end on that day in 1923. It really reshaped the entire political landscape.
It did.
I mean, the pro-treaty side, they evolved into Fine Gael.
Mm-hmm.
And the anti-treaty faction, under De Valera, formed Fianna Fáil.
Exactly. The two main parties in Irish politics today.
Born out of this conflict.
Yeah. Their rivalry has shaped Irish politics for almost a century.
It's amazing, isn't it?
And historian Diarmaid Farrador, he argues that the war, while fought by many with, you know, good intentions, it essentially sank the middle ground.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it forced people to choose sides.
So compromise and moderation.
Yeah, they became suspect.
And then, of course, there's De Valera. Even though he played a part in ending the war, he still believed in that ultimate goal of a republic.
Where he says, "Soldiers of liberty, the republic can no longer be defended successfully by your force of arms. Other means must be sought to safeguard the nation's right."
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It really shows that shift in strategy.
He saw that it couldn't be won on the battlefield anymore.
Not then, yeah.
And so he shifted his focus, and he ultimately achieved that goal, didn't he?
He did. I mean, through political means, he led Fianna Fáil to success and eventually became Taoiseach. Under his leadership, Ireland gradually cut those ties with Britain, and in 1949, they declared a republic.
What a journey.
Isn't it? I mean, that goal that seemed so impossible during those treaty negotiations,
yeah.
He achieved it. It just took a much longer, more complex path to get there.
Well, this has been an incredible deep dive.
It has.
Into such a pivotal moment in Irish history.
Yeah.
We've gone from the high-stakes diplomacy
mm-hmm.
to the absolute heartbreak and brutality of the Civil War.
It's a story filled with drama and tragedy, but also resilience.
Yeah, and I think it really offers us these valuable insights into the complexities of peacemaking, mm-hmm. of compromise,
yeah.
and just the sheer power of political ideals.
It reminds us that even when faced with seemingly insurmountable challenges, that human spirit, it can endure
yeah.
and forge a path forward.
So to everyone listening out there, as we step back into our own time, I think we're left with this cocoa. Even though the fighting stopped in 23, Did those divisions truly ever heal? And how might those echoes of the past, how might they still be felt in Ireland today? Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.